If I experience suffering because I'm getting old, it's because I have a model of myself that's other than what this is. This is what it is. Including dying, pain, loss, all of it. The models in our heads about it and the way we cling to it is where the root of the suffering is. The root of the suffering is the clinging basically to the idea that you're somebody. That there is a somebody, a separate somebody that's solid and real. And it's only relatively real. It isn't false, it's only relatively real. So you experience, finally, when you want to get free bad enough, you begin to experience your own suffering as grace. You don't ask for it. You don't say, give me suffering. But when it comes, you see it as something that's showing you a place where you're holding. Now that doesn't mean you can do that to another person. You can't go and say to them, suffering, great, grace. You have no moral right to awaken anybody. You couldn't do it anyway. But you really end up just creating an environment for another human being where if they want to come up for light, they're welcome to. If they want to awaken to who they are, they're fine. And if they don't, blessings. Because you don't understand the nature of the karma and why they have to be the way they are. So the kind of work I do, which through the organizations and the way I work with AIDS patients or in the SEVA Foundation, I work with blind in Guatemala, in Nepal and India, and people in Guatemala, that Mayan Indians that have had violence done to them. And these are cataract operations, and they're tool banks and seeds and wells and clothing and toys for the children and training for administration and all of the stuff that you do in countries and stuff like that. Because as you awaken to that channel 5 where you are part of everything and everything is part of you, everybody's suffering is no longer their suffering. It's our suffering. It's not even our suffering, it's the suffering. Don't even astralize it. It's the suffering. And we are part of the suffering. And when there is suffering, like if your hand is in a fire, you pull it out. If there's a splinter, you go to take it out. When there is real suffering and you identify with that suffering, there is some very intuitive, responsive thing that comes out of what you might say is the spontaneous generosity of the heart. It's the heart that says, let me help, or reaching out, or embracing, or including. And it's part of all of us. It's who we are. That's channel 5. That's the one of, we're one, you know, come on, it's this. So I am realizing that this is all my family. And what do you do when somebody in the family hurts? You do what you can to make them feel better. And if they're hungry, you feed them. And if they're blind, you help them see. And if they need structures, you help them with structures. And then you get the hell out. You don't start to rip them off for your own gratification. You just help as where the help is really needed to relieve the suffering as well as you can. So you, for another person, you work to relieve their suffering the way they interpret their suffering. The way you do it for yourself may be entirely different. One person hasn't eaten in 7 days and they're hungry and you feed them. Another, I may be fasting for 9 days and for 7 days I haven't eaten. And I don't want you to feed me. So you find yourself to be fully human with all of these paradoxes. I mean, it's just this, to acknowledge these planes of reality and live in them full time. We are one and we are separate. Suffering stinks and suffering's grace. All the spiritual practices awaken you to the one. Then you don't dwell just on that plane and reject the others, because the rejecting of the others is an attachment that keeps you from being free. To be free, you can't stand anywhere. So you've got to come back and make peace with your incarnation until you are, as Christ said, in the world but not of the world. You're both in it and not in it, and you're right in all the planes all at once. And you get them all together. You start to become impeccable on each plane. And on the plane of my psychological identity, I have a human heart, and it hurts like hell when somebody I love suffers. And as I love more and more people, it hurts more and more. And it breaks and breaks and breaks and breaks. And then there's another part of my being, a deeper quality of my heart, that embraces all the suffering and sits in absolute peace and equanimity. Because it sees the way in which suffering works in the unfolding of karma of people. You see a plane, when you go from, this is all tricky because it's really plane 4B, but when you go and look at the world of forms from the place of one, when you look at your manifesting into form in the universe, as it all comes out of you, comes out of the mind, the way the mind creates the universe, and you start to see the universe and all the suffering and all of it and all of it and all of it, there are, one of the most profound reactions is that of awe. And the awe, for me, has a component in it of appreciating the absolutely exquisitely articulated nature of the relationship between forms. It's as if, like when you study a snowflake, it's breathtaking, the complexity of the snowflake. And when you see the way in which ocean evaporates and forms clouds and rains and the whole processes of nature, the laws of nature, when you study the laws of astronomy, the laws of psychology, the laws of genetics, the laws of physics, the laws of biochemistry, everywhere if you go deep enough, you are absolutely awed by the exquisite nature of the law of it all. From that place, all of it is just unfolding just as it is. And there's no judgment required. Judgments are part of the law's full stuff. You're beyond it. You're just appreciating it all. And it's all, see, it's the word that catches people, but it's all perfect. Now, what happened to that part of you that acknowledged that? Because you get so busy thinking it all stinks. Or it's hard, or it's, ugh, or it's, oh, that's life. It's so extraordinary to embrace the paradox that your heart is breaking and there is suffering and it is all of the what it is with its unfairness and unjustness and all of it. And you're doing what you can to relieve it, and all of that, including your heart wanting to do what it can to relieve it, from another place, you're just watching the whole thing, and it's perfect. See, and then you challenge, you say, was Hitler perfect? Is the nuclear bomb perfect? If we kill ourselves with our unconscious runaway technology and greed, was that perfect? As long as you're standing in your separateness in which you're afraid of death, There's no way, and you're exclusively standing there, there's no way you can understand that concept of perfection. But I'd say, yeah, that's perfect. It's not good, and it's not right, and it's not just, but it's perfect. And if my heart and my wisdom can change it, that's perfect too. So do you see the tension is not only like planes, the tension is between the analytic mind and the intuitive heart. And these words are crude. Mind and heart really are all nonsense because we think down here as well as up here, and all the brain psychology is really interesting and it's very useful in response material, but it isn't necessarily the essence of the thing, because when you die, you're still around. And even when your brain gets eaten by ants. And how could that be? We bought science as our religion. We bought materialism and science and the intellect and the analytic mind and its offshoot technology as that which would save us. And what it's done is it's made life really interesting. But it sure as hell hasn't freed us. It's entangled us in the addictions to the things that we produce, that our mind produces. I go to so many peace rallies and the people there are so angry. And they're saying, if it was only peaceful out there, then I could be peaceful. And I say, if you can be peaceful in here, then it might be peaceful out there. And the peace comes from that balance of the perfection and its stinks. It comes from the balance of the mind and the heart. It doesn't come with destroying the skillful means of the intellect and the ability to articulate the and use an ego and all the individual differences of your body. That is all absolutely perfect on the planes it exists. You say the intellect is a beautiful servant. The problem is it became the master. And it's a subsystem. There are meta systems to it. And a subsystem can't know a system that's meta to it. And that tension between the mind and the heart says, the heart is tuned to the channel 5 where it's boundaryless. It's tuned into the space where when we are in it, the term conscious love takes on meaning. Because we are sitting in love. We're sitting in a boundaryless state with one another. When I say I am in love with, it means, it's interesting the way we use language. We say, I'm in love with her or him. What we're really saying when we're what we're also saying when we're saying that is he or she is the key stimulus that releases the mechanism in me that allows me to open the door into the place where I am love. So I fell into love. And since you're the cause and I don't know how to get there by myself, I want to possess you. Where will you be Thursday night? And Friday night? And forever? And don't die. And don't leave me. And the anxiety starts. Because you want to be there. You want to be on channel 5. You want to be God. You want to be in love. You want to be in the boundaryless place where you feel at home in the universe. How often do you feel at home in the universe? Have you noticed that? How often are you just at home? But all of these practices that alter consciousness and that open the heart, that quiet the mind, all the meditative practices, all this ways of serving as a yoga to awaken, like karma yoga that I do, all of that stuff All of it slowly, slowly starts to establish you in the part of your awareness where things are not separate from one another, where they're interdependent and they're not separate. And that's the level of consciousness from which ecological sensitivity arises, by the way. You're asking about where humans could be ecologically conscious. Once you are in that, resting in that, what happens is when you look at another being, you are looking at the divine manifestation, and you are looking at another being, and you're looking at them from the place of love, and so you're starting to experience being in love with more and more people. Some of you may have noticed it. And in a society, it can be pathological. If you're in the model that when I fall in love with somebody, I got to collect them. Because you collect one, you take them home, and then you're at the grocer and you're at the checkout counter and you look at the person and it happens again. Because you're in it. I mean, you don't need them to do it to you. You're it. So everywhere you look, you're going to see it. So what are you going to do with this one? And you've got one at home. A menage a trois. But it gets very complicated. My God, I mean, you know, how many can you do? What are you going to do, not look at anybody for the rest of your life? Aren't you afraid sometimes of looking at people for fear you'll fall in love with them? And then you don't know what to do because in your mind you've worked on a deprivation model so long because you've been busy being separate so long that when you taste that thing, you keep wanting to collect it. And if I don't have any room at home for any more, at least give me your telephone number. And if my telephone thing is full and I know I'll never call, at least let's acknowledge it to one another. Are you feeling what I'm feeling? Wow, well, bye. But what happens if it starts to happen with everybody on the street? What are you going to do then? I mean, you just plumb run out. You're driven to being with the beloved and doing nothing about it. You just walk by looking at it. You just be with it. You just go around being with it, being in love. It's a very interesting thing because you've got to give up the deprivation model to survive. And most people say, well, the deprivation model is right, so I just won't love people because I can't afford it. What plane is this silence on? Is this waiting for him to speak? Or is it just are all the words resounding within the silence? Is this silence full or empty? Gandhi once said, he wrote on a paper bag as the train was leaving a station and somebody had asked him for a message. He wrote, "My life is my message." When you taste the meaning of that, "My life is my message," and you have awakened to the reality of all of these parts of your own identity, you go from, "I rip off the earth," to, "I'll use it for what I need," to "I'm a steward of the earth," to "I am related to the earth because I'm part of the biotic community," to "Gaia, I am the earth," to "the earth is just a part of what I am." And it's all real. And What impeccability is that you don't do something on one plane that denies the truth of what's on another plane. You start to find the integrity between all that stuff. And the game of getting integrity, that's what I've been doing since 61 when I first realized my predicament. 30 years now. And I assume that's what you're doing too. And I don't know how we're doing. I forget less often. For a long time, I was so hooked on getting out there that I was just kind of airy-fairy flake. And I was, yeah, la la land. And then I turned around and I said, I gotta get it together on the material, psychological plane. So I started to do all this stuff. All right, just continued to do it, but I took it like it was real. But I did it from this place of oneness. I started to come back in, and it would be so seductive, I'd get lost in it. And then either I'd surround myself with people, we'd help each other remember, called satsang or sangha or the community or something, or text, holy books or practices, whatever. I built them into my life so that each time I'd forget, getting lost into the fascination of the uncooked separateness that I had to deal with, and all my sufferings and the dramas of them, and the will he, won't he, should he, shouldn't he, can't he, what will happen, you know, like, will it, won't it, oh. Do you love me, do you love me enough, will you always love me? I mean, I can give you melodramas that are just, oh, we all know them, we all roll in them, they're like honey and molasses, and yum, yum, yum. Tell me your story, I'll tell you mine. But I keep waking up sooner. I keep falling asleep into the dream, but I keep waking up sooner to realize it's just relatively new. When I work with somebody that's dying, I literally fall in love with them. I fall into the space of love with them, which means that I have to acknowledge the part of me that is dying, the part of me that is the pain, the part of me that is all of it. It's a very scary edge to get that close to that much suffering and stay open. But it's your pushing away of suffering, your denial, your distortion, the way you do it through kindness, through something that keeps you separate from it, being afraid to be in love with all of it, with the mother in all of her manifestations, her horrible and beautiful ones at the same moment. It's that reactivity to the suffering that keeps you caught in your separateness. And ultimately, when the planes are together, you are like this with all of it. You are eating the suffering for lunch. You're right in the presence of it, and your human heart is breaking because it hurts so bad because we hurt so much. And there's another part of you that's giggling. That's giggling with the absolute perfection of the universe. And the question is, can you cry and giggle at the same time? In the Seva Foundation, when things get really heavy, when we're dealing with death and pain and suffering and blindness and all kinds of government crap and stuff like that, at some point, one of our board members, Wavy Gravy the Clown, will say, you know, if you don't have a sense of humor, it just isn't funny. Thank you very much for...